third case this morning, William Moss v. Gary Hanning.
Good morning and thank you. My name is John Curley. I represent the plaintiff and appellant William Moss, to please the court and counsel. The first time we were here on this case, about 3 years ago, this court examined the district judge's opinion that Mr. Moss held a position that was exempt from RUTAN. This court, in relying on a fairly substantial body of case law and precedent, said what we have to do is analyze whether Mr. Moss held a position that requires a particular political loyalty in order to perform the functions of the job. But in looking at his position description, we cannot tell if he really truly held a position that required political loyalty. So this case needs to go back to the district court. A more full record needs to be developed, and we need to determine if, in fact, he performed or could perform the kinds of functions that required political loyalty. So we went back, conducted about two and a half years' worth of discovery to answer many of, and even more than, the questions that this court said needed to be examined. After doing that, the parties filed summary judgment motions. And what the district court did in granting summary judgment for the defendants was essentially ignore what this court said needed to be done.
I'm not sure that's true. I mean, it seems to me there are a number of things we've learned since that time, if we're at this level and we're not at the qualified immunity level. One of the things that we've learned more about is the process by which the state came up with this RUTAN classification, a process I would note that would have been favorable to the Republicans for most of the time that this was underway, so there's no reason to think that there was that kind of political motivation, and it's actually a process that the state applies to everything. Secondly, we've learned more about where this job fits into the grand scheme, the impression I was left with is that it's somewhere in between. It's not that this is a person who is, you know, a low-level filing clerk, and it's not, on the other hand, the right-hand person of the governor. It's somewhere in between, which leads me to think that, at a minimum, qualified immunity may well have been the right call.
If we compare the job duties for Mr. Moss's position to other job duties in other cases, for example, the Selch case. And as this court pointed out previously, you know, Selch was a guy, he was a district highway superintendent in Indiana. And as this court pointed out, Selch was a guy who on a daily basis had interaction with the public. He took, I don't know, 20, 30
I'm
phone
calls. I'm familiar with the case.
Yeah. This is a guy who was a decision maker on issues that could most certainly affect the administration. But
let me say why Selch, maybe this is because of what we've been through recently in Illinois, looks maybe more like this case than it might have seemed at the time to the earlier panel. We, as I understand it, the sign shop is responsible for all signs on all roads in Illinois, right?
No, that is a very overly broad statement.
What about the toll roads?
He has nothing to do with toll roads. I mean, this is not part of the tollway authority at all.
Okay, so those gigantic signs that used to say Rod Blagojevich, governor, over all the open road tolling were not within his authority?
He had absolutely no authority whatsoever to decide what signs would go up or where they would go.
Oh, I understand that, but the point of Selch was in part, let's say, pacing the work. And so, you know, you only have so many people in your office. You've got to decide, you know, we're going to do this work today. We're going to do some other work tomorrow. And I assume that kind of pragmatic work decision is made in the sign shop, too.
No. No, not at all.
They do all work all the time? How can they do that?
What happens is there are nine districts in Illinois, highway districts. There are nine. And those districts are the ones who make the decisions on where signs are going to go and when. And they simply order those from the sign shop.
And the sign shop can't make 100% of the signs at every moment unless they've you know, found some way to supersede the laws of physics.
The way the sign shop operates is that all signs are on a cycle, which is not set by Mr. Moss. Everyone agrees he's not the guy that determines that. That's determined at a much higher level than he's at. In fact, his two immediate supervisors testified. That's way above anything that Bill Moss does, those, what you're specifically asking me. But it's also established not only by people in IDOT that are much higher than Bill Moss, but also the federal government dictates what you're going to do with your signage.
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm making a somewhat different point. I mean, the federal government also dictates standards for road construction, but then somebody has to send a crew out to fix a pothole. So the fact that someone is dictating standards does not strike me as dispositive of what somebody in an intermediate position, like chief of the sign shop, which is under the Secretary of the Department of Transportation, which I understand is within the operations section of that department.
Well, you have, IDOT actually has 10 separate divisions and offices,
right.
And then by the time you get down to where Mr. Moss is, you're about, in the org chart.
It spreads out.
It spreads out in your
vertically.
Down.
It's,
right.
It spreads out, so
right.
Mr. Moss isn't, it depends if you're a glass half full or glass half empty.
Right. Let's take, for example, Tomsec versus City of Chicago, where this court found that this was a political job. Well, Mr. Tomsack was in a position where he spent about 30% of his time deciding budget issues and long-term and short-term issues. And when the water commissioner was gone, Mr. Tomsack was the number one guy in charge. He would actually be the acting commissioner of the water department.
You know, but you're really into these line-drawing problems, and what's concerning me is you have not pointed to a single case where somebody in an intermediate kind of job like this one was found to be so clearly Rutan covered, if you will, that there was that this case can't be disposed of on qualified immunity.
Well, you're never going to find a case specifically on point. I mean, we're never going
similar cases,
and we have.
You've been citing all sorts of cases, but they're all on the other side of the equation.
Well, I think Selch is the one.
Well,
I think
Selch was decided after a trial, right?
I can't recall if it was a trial or not.
I remember attending the trial.
Okay, yeah, I don't remember that.
and it was a difficult call. And that was not decided on qualified immunity, if I recall correctly.
Well,
in this case, Mr. Curley, correct me if I'm wrong, the district court didn't decide the merits at all, did it?
In Selch or this case?
This case.
No, the court never
Judge
got
Scott
to that.
Simply decided that the defendants were entitled to rely on the list that had been developed in prior administrations. This was back in about 2004, right?
Mr. Moss was terminated in 2004.
Right. Okay.
It was determined to be exempt by CMS, I believe, 1992.
Right. And that list had remained in place. So I don't know that there's a whole lot of point right now about debating the fine points of which side of the line this job is on, unless there is a good reason why the defendants were not entitled to rely on the list in good faith.
Well, the number one reason is they didn't look at the list.
But they know, though, that this job was double exempt?
Mr. Millett, I asked him specifically that question, and he said in his testimony, I never looked at a list. I didn't look at that list. I just assumed when Jake Miller came to me and said, let's get rid of this Republican, I just assumed he was exempt, that somebody might have already considered that. He didn't look at that list.
But if he had looked at it, he would have found out that it was exempt. It was double exempt.
Well, however, though, remember, their argument is they should be able to rely on the fact that they saw Mr. Moss's name on a list. And so the question becomes, well, how can you rely on his name being on a list if you never looked at it? It's impossible. It's just, it's humanly impossible.
But the one guy does look at the list, one who sends the email.
Yeah, Miller was directed to identify all double exempt positions in the department and sent that email to Millett saying he's a double exempt employee. Isn't that good enough?
No. No, that's totally different than saying that I have immunity because I'm relying on a list that CMS produced, which, by the way, there's no evidence in the record that the list anybody looked at was actually prepared by CMS. I would also add the point that the evidence that the defendants relied on to say this job was on a CMS list was an affidavit by a CMS employee named Larry Plummer. And if you look closely at Mr. Plummer's affidavit, what he said was, hey, this job was designated as exempt by CMS at least up through 2002. Mr. Moss was fired in 2004, not 2002. So we don't even have any evidence in the record that this was definitely determined to be exempt by CMS the year he was fired.
Is there any evidence the other way?
I'm sorry. No, there is. No. No.
Any indication that that list was modified, changed?
No, they presented no evidence one way or another on that. No, they just said up to 2002 it was on a list.
So I want to ask you a question out of left field a little bit. There was another aspect of this case that dealt with an official capacity request for injunctive relief, but you haven't said a word about that here. So I'm wondering whether you have forfeited your right to go back and pursue that kind of relief. Obviously, qualified immunity is something that's an individual capacity point and it goes to damages.
Right. No, I don't think we've forfeited that point. In fact, there has even been a substitution of the correct defendants who are holding these offices now.
Well, here there are, but what the district court does at the bottom line is say all pending motions are denied as moot. This case is closed, period. So the judgment that you're appealing from sure looks to me like a final judgment, and I don't see any briefing on your part attempting to preserve the official capacity part of your case.
I believe that we've appealed the entire judgment.
But you didn't brief anything to tell us why the official capacity part is still alive, did you?
No, I think that it is.
Well, all right, we'll see.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I will save the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Walsh?
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. I'm Mary Walsh. I'm here on behalf of the defendants. The question this case raises, of course, is whether summary judgment was proper in this case. And the answer to that is on this developed record, which was lacking in Moss 1, the answer has to be yes, because the plaintiff failed to provide enough evidence from which a reasonable jury could find in his favor. But in addition, qualified immunity applies. And I would say, Judge Hamilton, that in fact, the district court did address the merits, because what it said was, first it said there's qualified immunity because under Riley and Pearson, it's reasonable to rely on a previous job description, and then he extended it to the CMS Rutan exempt designation, unless the plaintiff shows that the job description, and thus the designation, which is derived from the job description, is inherently systemically unreliable. But then it went on to say that even if we were to apply on the merits the Riley-Pearson test, here it would pass because this particular job description and the derived Rutan exempt designation pass the systemically unreliable test.
But that's just qualified immunity, right?
No. It's on the merits, because he's saying what as I understood it, what the district court said was that they have qualified immunity because the systemically unreliable test postdates the discharge here. But even if it didn't, that test actually applied here.
Are you saying the list is conclusive, that summary judgment should be granted on the merits because a job is on the list?
Because the job is on a list that was not proven to be systemically unreliable.
So a plaintiff, we've in essence delegated the law and fact-finding roles of the federal courts to the CMS?
No, under Pearson and Riley, what this court said was that if you have a job description that describes a Rutan exempt position, then that that designation or that understanding, those facts are found unless a plaintiff can show that that job description is systemically unreliable.
That there's only a procedural dimension to this, and that the court wouldn't also be saying, and in addition, you know, does this job match the criteria that Rutan set out? Because I have to say, it seems to me your argument on qualified immunity seems to me to be a much stronger one than
Certainly.
Your argument on the underlying merits. I keep saying to myself, sign shop chief? You know, where does that have, you know, where is that something that actually implements or doesn't implement either a Republican agenda or a Democratic agenda or a Green Party agenda or anybody else's
right.
agenda?
Well, but I think we know, you know, from Riley and the other cases that the mundane details of providing essential services to the populace, such as road signs, you know, all the highway signs, you know, all the freeway signs, those are all within the compass of the shop sign, and he decides the priority of those signs, plus the special signs like Welcome to Illinois, you know, Governor so-and-so, Mayor, you know, so-and-so Governor. So,
are you saying that your opposing counsel was wrong that he does provide those things?
On the highways and on the freeways, not the tollways. The tollways are different.
Well, we were specifically talking about the toll road.
Right, not the toll road, but there are plenty of highways and, you know, and freeways in Illinois that all
highway
of these
sign that says Welcome to Illinois, Pat Quinn Governor or something is
those are special signs, right? And those go those are within the purview. I mean, the sign shop makes those. And
do you really think that if the sign that says, you know, speed limit 55 looks a little old and tattered, people are going to think the governor is doing a bad job?
I think that if somebody has the authority to prioritize the you know, Pat Quinn governor sign and doesn't do it in as fast as the, you know, I mean, those signs changed within 24 hours when people, you know, so you know that there's a political element to this kind of decision making, and the same thing, you know, with we know in Chicago that mundane details like snow plowing can change elections. I mean, we understand these things, so that this sort of thing does have a political component to it.
On interstate highways, where the federal government has regulated the size and type and location of signs. And when they're knocked down by storms or whatever, is this department charged with replacing them?
Right, right. They're the ones, and the sign shop chief is the one who prioritizes that replacement. I mean, that's what Mr. Hill testified to. So if there was, you know, if there was any doubt, there was testimony, unrefuted testimony, that he's the one who prioritized those signs. So that, you know, so that these sorts of,
so
I know it sounds
laying down for 3 weeks or a month.
People get annoyed by these things. I mean, it may not bother some people, but other people get very annoyed by these things. And just as, you know, I mean, you can imagine also, for example, the hydro stripping system. It's better, it's cheaper, it's faster. Can you not imagine that the governor, a governor would tout something like this? We have improved our system for you. We have made it better, cheaper, faster to have signs for you to use when you are on the highways and byways. And so that's exactly the kind of thing that can make or break an election, depending on when it happens and how big it is and so on.
Ms. Welsh, could I ask you to focus on something that your colleague addressed,
mm-hmm.
and that is what the record shows factually about information about this double exempt status, mm-hmm. who knew what when?
Right. What we know was that at first Mr. Miller, who was under Mr. Millett, you know, sent the email saying, I saw this guy, I know he's on the list, which, you know, I know that he's Rutan exempt, because we also know from the record, it's undisputed, that CMS sends a list, and that one of the lists is in the record. It's in fact, plaintiff's summary judgment motion, that CMS, and it's dated 02, that CMS sends a list to each department telling them who's Rutan exempt and who's exempt from the, you know, from the personnel code. We know there's evidence, unrefuted evidence, that this position was on that list since 1992, since the designations were made because of Rutan. We know that Millett knows that he was on the list by being told by Miller, but we also know that if Millett had looked at the list, if Martin had looked at the list, that Mr. Moss would be on the list. So there's nothing there. I mean, that argument is really a red herring. What we do know, however, is that Mr. Martin didn't even know what political affiliation was, what Mr. Moss's political affiliation was, and we also know that Mr. Martin didn't know what his replacement's political affiliation was. And those are under Hall requirements to show but-for causation. And so that's another reason why on the merits the plaintiff has to lose, because he couldn't prove causation as to Miller, as to Secretary Martin, and he also couldn't prove it as to Millett, because what we know is that nothing seems to have happened to the original paperwork that Mr. Miller put together and got approved by Millett. But then Mr. Dubay came in, was asked to find an opening for somebody who had a certain skill set, and he saw that there was an opening, it was Rutan exempt, and that was the reason that Mr. Moss was discharged.
Months later?
Yes, that was months later, right, exactly.
In light of Miller's email, though, do you want us to treat this as if this was not politically motivated?
Well, what I'm saying is there's nothing to show that Mr. Martin, Secretary Martin, saw the email or knew anything
about... You're familiar with this court's cat's paw line of cases in employment discrimination.
Right, I am. But somewhat. I mean, we didn't discuss that in, you know,
where, in essence,
this case. This is Staub.
The lower-ranking folks who do bear some kind of prohibited animus then manipulate the decision.
Right. But I don't think, but again here, I don't think there was any, I mean, we, if you look at the first attempt to discharge him, which was admittedly for political purposes and Millett knew it, although, you know, Martin didn't. But then nothing happened to that. That stalled out apparently in the governor's office. It never came back to the department. So it was revived when somebody else who didn't even know about Mr. Miller's attempt to discharge plaintiff for political reasons, that Mr. Dubay was said, do you have a job that for somebody who has this certain skill set? He looks on the list. He doesn't know plaintiff's politics. He doesn't even know the politics. We don't know the politics of the replacement. All we know is that there needed to be a job. There was a request for a job with somebody's skill, with this skill set, and plaintiff's job was chosen. It could have been any job, but it was this job. So it had nothing to do with plaintiff. It certainly had nothing to do with plaintiff's politics.
Why isn't that a jury question, though? I mean, I can understand that you'd be able to make that argument because of the time that passed. But on the other hand, this is a fairly small set of people, and it seems highly coincidental at best that it happens to be Moss's job that they pick for this political appointment. I don't know why it was a political appointment, whether it was party-oriented,
we don't know,
nepotism-oriented, whether it was anything else-oriented. I'm not taking a position on it, Mr.
Well, I mean, that's one problem. We don't know if it was a politically related appointment. And under Hall, you have to know both somebody at least, a decision-maker the paw of the cat, you know, has to know both the political affiliation of the discharge person and the political affiliation of the replacement. And here there's no evidence of the political affiliation of the replacement, evidence.
Why is that? If that's like saying if I'm motivated to fire somebody because they're African-American, that I have to know that I'm going to replace them with someone of a different ethnic background 3 months later. That can't be right.
Well, no. I mean, they already knew who the replacement was going to be. I mean, when they chose the replacement, they didn't know. But under Hall, you have to show that political motivation was the but-for cause. You have to show both the political affiliation of the discharge person and the political, because otherwise you don't know if political affiliation was the motivation. I mean,
from Miller's email?
Miller's email, no, because remember, Miller's email died, and Dubay restarted again or started a new discharge proceeding with regard to the sign shop chief. I mean, he didn't know who Moss was. He didn't know Moss's political affiliation. And remember, not everybody in Rutan-exempt positions, you know, was a Republican. I mean, in fact, there were Democrats in Rutan-exempt positions. So over the years. And so it wasn't a foregone conclusion that whoever was in the sign shop chief position as a Rutan exam person had to be, was necessarily politically affiliated with the Republicans. And similarly, there is no evidence in the record whatsoever that the replacement's greater political involvement was the reason that he was chosen to be the replacement. And therefore, there's no but-for causation. And if without but-for causation, without knowledge, you don't have but-for causation. And without but-for causation, you can't show liability, which is the merits as opposed to just qualified immunity. But I'd like to go through just a little bit what the discretionary things is. I think as the court pointed out earlier, this is one of the in-between. It's not, you know, the number two guy like Tomczak. It's more like Selch, who's an in-between guy. And so you look at and remember, Elrod says, you know, it's really hard to draw these lines between who's for whom political affiliation is required and for whom it's not.
Selch ran a sub-district, so he had management things that did directly impact on the public, whether plowing snow or those types of things. How does this?
Right. Well, again, this is. I mean, these signs have a political element to them. They have the "Welcome to Illinois," you know, "I'm the governor" political element. They have the special, you know, "This highway brought to you by I don't know who." You know, they have those sorts of elements. And there's the priority problem. We also know that he is not. You know, plaintiffs imply that he's just a blue collar or a technical guy. He's fifth down the chain of command, but he's also got at least two levels below that, because we know that from his job description. He also was able, as I said earlier, to prioritize the orders, which has an obvious political element. You know, you prioritize the people you like, and you don't prioritize the people you don't like.
You finish up, could you say a word about the official capacity aspect of this case?
Well, I believe that's why I think that the court did, in fact, reach the merits, because I don't think it could have terminated the case unless it did, because qualified immunity, as the court suggested, would apply only to the monetary relief. And that's why we, in our brief, said, you know, this is they failed to prove entitlement to either monetary or injunctive relief. So if there are no further questions,
thank
we
you,
ask
counsel.
That the court find out the merits, or if not, on qualified immunity at the very least. Thank you very much.
How much time? 2.5 minutes.
Thank you. In the 2.5 minutes I have, I couldn't possibly address all of the factual misstatements that have just been made, and would invite the court to examine the record very closely. One of those is dealing with the special signs that the court has asked about. We addressed that exhaustively in discovery, the issue of special signs. And it was very clear from Mr. Moss's superiors that he absolutely did not prioritize those special signs. That was a huge point of contention in discovery. He did not. And in fact, Jack Hook, who was two steps up from Mr. Moss, was one of the people that was instrumental in creating the chief of the sign shop position. And he said, the reason we created this position is because we wanted to take politics out of sign decisions. We did not want the person who was in Mr. Moss's position to have to deal with political issues. Because he said, you know, signs are important to some people. Some politicians want special signs. You've gone into towns where it will say, you know, "Welcome to Smithtown, Illinois, home of so-and-so, 1998 track champion." Okay, those kinds of signs, the welcome signs, were specifically not in Mr. Moss's discretion. That was higher than where he was at. He could not make those decisions. This job was created to take that out of the position, specifically. As far as Mr. Moss being on a list, there is no evidence that Mr. Millett was told by Jacob Miller, "Mr. Moss is on a list, let's fire him." That is not what the testimony was. Far from that. As far as knowing politics of Mr. Moss and the replacement, the record is very clear that these people did in fact know Mr. Moss was...
I don't think it was clear at all with respect to Mr. Martin. It was just kind of like, oh, everybody must have known, and that's really not good enough.
Well, with respect to... Yeah, Millett, it's very clear. He got an email. He was told. He can't possibly say he didn't know.
Millett's told, but Mr. Martin, there's no confidence.
Mr. Dubit testified that when he came into the position, the way things worked was he would always have to go to Mr. Millett and Mr. Martin to discuss with them two things. Number one, we want to hire someone to forward the agenda. We've got a liaison who said, find this guy a job, which in this case was Joe Athey.
But we don't know anything about Athey. And frankly, knowing the Illinois legislature, it seems to me at least as likely that interests of nepotism or some other non-political interest could have motivated that as political party. We just don't know.
I think we do know. I would respectfully disagree because Mr. Dubit said, look, when I would get from a liaison a request to find somebody a job, we knew that this was a political request. Somebody
it's a political request, but it could have been a very important Republican member of the Illinois legislature that they were trying to keep on their side. I mean, you can imagine almost anything. I don't see that's actually evidence.
I see that I'm out of time.
You want to answer Judge Wood's question?
Sure. Thank you. Yes, I will. When the way things worked with the Blagojevich administration, and you can actually see it on the Miller email, you can see two names. You can see the name of Janulis. You can see the name of Flood. John Janulis was the state chair of the Democratic Party. He and Mr. Flood were the patronage chiefs for Governor Blagojevich. And these patronage jobs would come through that office from the office of the governor and filter down to the various agencies so that they could make political hires. And that's why Jake Miller put Flood and Janulis in the email to say, yes, we're going to go ahead and get the preferred political candidate a job.
Did he testify to that effect, or are you just drawing that inference?
I asked Mr. I know that factually myself, but also we asked questions of Millett as to who these guys were, and he said these are the people that are in the governor's office. So we know that. We know that's how the process worked. I mean, they can sit there and say we didn't know, but yet they admit this is what the process was.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.